Hi there, this is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the NSavvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working well with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Our guest today is Michael DiBiasio. He's a New York filmmaker who recently released his feature film, The Video Blogs, on iTunes and other video on demand platforms. The Video Blogs is a film that tackles mental health, but it's engaging, accessible, even, dare I say it, enjoyable. What's that like, addressing a challenging topic in an engaging way? Michael comes on the show to discuss that. Plus, he talks about raising money, most of the budget, in fact, tens of thousands of dollars, through Seed and Spark, a filmmaking crowdfunding platform. We also talk about how to encourage sustained vulnerability in ourselves and in our actors. Is there such a thing as oversharing? Can swearing help in discussing difficult issues? And what's it look like when one artist's honesty and courage inspires others to take action? All that and more coming up in our conversation with Michael DiBiasio. Stick around.
This is the NSavvides podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. Michael DiBiasio, welcome to the NSavvides podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've worked with actress Rebecca De Ornelis on a couple of shorter projects. What made you two decide to do a feature together?
Yeah, so Rebecca and I are, full disclosure, we're married.
Well, there you go. That's a little detail. It's like, there was that, yes.
Although, you know, it's funny, this has come up a couple of times. The first project that we worked on together, nobody on the cast or crew knew. We weren't married at the time, but we were, I think, engaged. Nobody knew that we were together, even all the way through, like, producing the film together and rehearsal and until like the second day of a 3-day shoot. That speaks a little bit to our relationship in that we try to really keep it about the project. Mm-hmm. So thereby, like, keeping it professional, so professional, perhaps, especially in early stuff, that nobody knew about that. But to specifically answer the question, you know, early on in our relationship, it's probably one of the things that we bonded over, Rebecca being an actor and a fan of movies, in addition to her work in theater, which, she does apart from our work together. And, you know, me being, at the time, I guess, a budding filmmaker, I'd only made one short up until that point. In addition to kind of just, I think, maybe admiring each other in other ways, I think we also really came to believe in each other's talent. That doesn't always work. I mean, it's like some people work together, whether they're in or out of a relationship, they work together over and over again. And sometimes you grow together and the work gets better, or sometimes...
Yeah, sometimes it does. I mean, some people have the professional relationship, but not the personal one. And then they have some have the other thing where it's like, we have a meaningful relationship, but we're going to work on different things. So it's neat that you two can work together both ways.
Yeah. Rebecca's always been very supportive of my work, but she's also always pushed me to be better. Mm-hmm. She's always the first person to read, other than me, to read usually like a third draft of a script. She'll always give notes. She'll give notes all the way through the process of making something. And I've gotten better at listening to those.
Right.
She's brought so much to each project in those, like, kind of more standard terms. But I've also think I've become a better filmmaker and director, especially on set, as a result of having shared a life so closely with an actor with a good craft and good priorities in terms of, like, the role of the performer in the films that I've made.
Sounds like it's been a mutually beneficial collaboration for you two. So kudos to you for that.
Yeah, thanks.
Give us your elevator pitch for Video Blogs, your current project that you all recently got out in VOD, right?
There's kind of two facets to the project. As you know, as a standalone fictional narrative, it's about a struggling young woman whose life takes a surprise turn when a troubled teenager finds her private video journal. In many ways, it's a story of a friendship between a friendship and kind of mutual support among and between three different women from three different racial and class backgrounds who are all maybe individually struggling with day-to-day mental health issues that we all face and or distinct, you know, manifestations of depression and anxiety in particular. And so that kind of leads me to the other part of it, which is, you know, a lot of our motivation for making the film and a big part of our release strategy in terms of trying to get it out to the right people who we hope will enjoy it and get something out of it. The whole project has been about trying to contribute to a greater dialogue on mental health in America today. And I say that to mean both like in today's like, you know, socioeconomic climate, but also just, you know, in this strange time where, you know, arguably like the how we interact with each other and like the definition of a human being is becoming more fluid because we're always staring into screens or interacting on screens. And we wanted to bring some discussion of that into the project as well.
I responded to the part of the film where your characters are trying to have that personal connection through technology. Talk a little bit about that, about how our tendency to rely on our electronic devices can be impersonal, but it can also allow for added connection.
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's what happens narratively in the film is very, very much inspired by my own personal experience. I found myself a couple of years ago just not in a great place with my physical and mental spiritual health. I was just, it was still the post-depression years. I was in a depression, the post-recession years.
Right.
And,
kind of coincides, right? Like, I can't find work. What are we going to do? I think a lot of people could relate during that time.
Yeah. And it just felt hopeless. I felt isolated. I was isolated. You know, one of the first, you know, I found myself at that point, literally like working part-time with in a closet. Like my office at the time was like a converted closet.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, thanks guys. Like, yeah, we took out a few of the office jackets. Here you go, buddy. Enjoy.
But you know what? At the same time, like I had a job and
not a given these days. Yeah, that's right.
But over time, like it just, all these pieces started coming together, you know, taking care, getting into therapy, taking care of my mental health, trying to figure out what were the next steps were going to be in my work as an artist, which eventually led me to relaunch my website. I had started a blog like twice and shut it down twice. And my current site has now been up for it's in its fourth year. And this film is about 2.5 years old.
You say you shut down the blog twice. Was it just finding the time? Was it discouraging feedback?
No, the feedback actually at the time was pretty good. I used to be one of those like kind of angry, like, why don't people understand all this, like bitter, like I have all the answers and I can be sarcastic kind of bloggers, which is like, it's just really, in addition to like there already being plenty of those out there, it was just exhausting. And I think a part of me knew that, like, even though I liked having the outlet and sometimes like some semblance of, because I've always still been an idealist, so some parts of that would still peek through, or the idealism underneath that kind of pain driven kind of outside in kind of stuff. People were reading and responding, but I would just burn out, and I just wasn't where I needed to be in terms of being honest with myself as a person and as a writer.
Okay, got it. That makes sense.
And what ultimately ended up happening was between that site, joining Twitter. You know, Rebecca and I have been crowdfunding since before there was crowdfunding, really. So we had done a lot on like email and Facebook in the past, getting films going, and that had kept me a little bit more connected to people than I otherwise would be. And, you know, the incremental blogging as well. Like I've always been writing and trying to get it out to people, but this last go around with the blog and then later my podcast, which is kind of an offshoot of the blog, you know, it just coincided with being ready to be more honest with what was actually going on in me, and in terms of being more vulnerable, dealing with the, you know, social anxiety that I was dealing with at the time, the depression, all the complicated feelings about what was going on in the world post-recession and et cetera. So to just kind of like wrap it up, like over time, I just started seeing so much benefit of sharing my experiences on the blog, on Facebook, on Twitter, meeting people, for instance, on Twitter, and then in real life, and realizing that we hear all these things about these technologies and how they could be bad, or how they're used to control us, or could be used to control us, or keep us, you know, placated and, you know, whatever. But there's a flip side to that. And especially think if you look at what some people and companies, you know, well-meaning companies and nonprofits, and even, you know, President Obama, for instance, like there's a lot of great grassroots, like activism and community building that can be done with these technologies as well. And I've, you know, I've benefited from that personally, in terms of my health and happiness, and ultimately in cultivating like what hopefulness I did have that I just wasn't in touch with years ago. So I wanted to kind of take that experience into this project.
All right. Well, speaking of crowdfunding, you all funded video blogs through Seed and Spark, the platform. You mentioned that it was entirely funded through that. So I'm assuming that means the budget for the film is what you raised, $21,665, or did you mean that kind of vaguely, like entirely funded, but we met others and...
Yeah, sure. No, production was entirely paid for by that budget.
Uh-huh.
And after that, based on... We also went into this whole thing with a business model that we've been evolving, or, you know, business plan that we've been evolving and updating the whole time. Ended up taking up all of that money to get through to the rough cut. So between that and once we got into the Big Vision Empty Wallace Distribution Lab, which was a big step for us, we met with some distributors and kind of updating our business plans and just kind of getting a little lucky. Right around when we were going to start going out for additional funding, which we weren't sure if we were going to go out for additional funding or try to raise some more money via crowdfunding, which we were a little nervous about because it just was a lot of work, and we didn't want our audience to feel like they had to go back in and support us again, even though it was just a monumentally difficult task to even get the film shot on that kind of a budget. So we ended up coming into an additional investment that allowed us to finish the film and get us the minimum marketing budget that we wanted to try to test out some of the theories of our model, such that we can kind of also gather data for maybe the next one.
And that was made possible through your distribution partners?
The distribution partners, I think, gave us a little bit of credibility.
Oh, I see. To help get the final finishing funds for
yeah, we basically brought on like a financial partner to help us the rest of the way. And we actually also ran it by our backers and just be like, look, we're not trying to just make a film and get it out. That's the first thing that we're trying to do. We're trying to make a great film and get it out to you because you're the reason that it exists and that will not change. But the reality is like our ambitions being what they are, we want to try to do a little bit more. We want to try to make some noise with this. And also it's just like, you know, as our first feature, and you always aim high in terms of what you can do within limited budgets in a particular time frame, and it never works out that way.
You had done a crowdfunding campaign with Seed and Spark before on The Confession and possibly on other projects, but this one was your biggest one by far, at least as far as I can tell. And it also seems like it's a very personal film for you and Rebecca in different ways. What was that like trying to put together a big crowdfunding campaign for something so personal to you both?
Yeah, that's another good question. It's kind of a contradiction, or it's an exact contradiction, but at the same time, it made it easy and difficult. The easy part was I just don't believe that, especially if you're asking people to take a leap of faith to help you make something that doesn't exist yet, I don't think that that should be anything but like an authentic, heartfelt, personal story. And whether that's like something as sensitive as like mental health, or as like, without adding any judgment to this, like a fraught subject like that, because of the stigma that comes with it, that we're trying to fight, I think that it just, it's going to get so unless you're very lucky, or you have the most fantastic idea that's just like a lot of fun, like a high concept idea, it's going to get so difficult at several points when you're crowdfunding, because it's just a big, hard thing to do, especially if you're raising, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or more without any real surety of whether that's going to work or not, which is how it went for us. I think the only way it's going to work is if at the end of the day, when you're exhausted, or when you want to quit, or when you have no choice but to like blow up some part of your strategy and scramble to figure out something else, or when you have to go out and ask for so many favors every single day to just spread the word about the campaign, or to build up your funding amounts, you really have to care about it more than anything else, because otherwise, like, how are you going to find the motivation to go out and do that? The difficult part of it is just the daily, you know, struggle with fear and doubt, which is just like, you know, approaching the, you know, arguable like insanity of it. It's like, I'm asking people together to help me scratch together $20,000 to tell a really like personal story that if I do it, I'm just going to be revealing this like vulnerable private side of me to who knows how many people, if like our greatest dreams with the project, or, you know, some smaller version of that were to come true. So it's tough. It's definitely like a crucible.
I want to take a quick break from our conversation with Michael D. Biasio to tell you a little bit more about some of the things I do when I'm not working on this show. In fact, I've done crowdfunding campaigns and other promotional videos for others. One that I did was for Justin Reyna's musical Legend City. A producer happened to see the video we made, and he liked it so much that he's been working with Justin ever since to make the project come to life in a way that's even bigger than what they had originally envisioned. You all listen to the show, you know that I take the time to get to know my guests, and I feel the same way about the clients I work with. My favorite part of that story is I'm still working with Justin. Just a few days ago, in fact, I was doing additional shooting for them as they take their musical to the next level. I want to work with you in similar ways. Sure, you can find someone on Craigslist. He might come in for a day, he's done with it, moved on to other things, or you get the big company, the kind of place that has hundreds of accounts. Once they do your video, they're probably done. They've got to move on. It's not like that with me. I worked on Justin's video so many months ago. We're still in touch. We're still working together professionally, but we're also friends. If that kind of thing appeals to you and you have a big idea, a big vision, music, something special you want to share the world, I can help you get that message out. You can reach me at podcast@ncivitis.com. Once again, podcast@ncivitis.com. Tell me what it is you want to share with the world, and I will help you do that more effectively with video. All right, now let's get back to our conversation with Michael D. Biasio. You all did something interesting with the campaign. From the beginning, you were mentioning that you wanted some of the people who donated to also be judges for the outreach aspect, the dialogues part, where you encourage others to also share their video blogs about some of their mental health challenges or tell related stories along those lines. Talk about that aspect of the project now that it's completed and you've had all those submissions.
Sure. That's an important part of the project as well. Which is the Video Blogs Dialogue is a user-generated video contest that we ran alongside the film. And that's we opened up for submissions where people could submit their own video blogs about a mental health issue or any other like subject that would typically be considered difficult to talk about, or that people don't talk about as often as perhaps some people would like. And we asked anyone could submit for a chance to be included in a special version of the film in the credits, but the majority of the contest had to do with opening the possibility of an entrant age 18 to 24 to submit for a chance to win what ended up being a $2,000 grant from the production, as well as consultations from Seed and Spark and Big Vision Empty Wallet and 4 Mile Circus, and then mentorship from Rebecca and I, all of which would go towards the creation of their own short film about mental health. We wanted to do that because it's just part of a tactile way with today's technologies as a tool in which we could put our money where our mouth is in terms of our reasons for making the film. Again, which are to contribute to a greater dialogue about mental health and to advocate for a more positive, hopeful use of technology, which we believe this is. And then, you know, also just to pay it forward and to help some younger artists who may be where we were several years ago and struggling to give it their own try in terms of opening up and expressing themselves in a way that could maybe be healing for the artist and for the audience, their eventual audience as well. And you can go on our website, videoblogsfilm.com, and you can watch the submissions. And to be honest, like so many of them were so moving and so impressive to us, even like considering what I just said, it's just like some of these young people are already being so much more honest than we ever would have been at their age. So we're really looking forward to helping them maybe take the next step in their craft.
You mentioned the film is a more hopeful use of technology. Can you think of an example of something that's less hopeful, not ideal use of technology?
Yeah, I mean, well, so you see it with like trolling in particular.
Okay, sure. Like all the negativity that comes up from people being anonymous online or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, on the one hand, the internet gives you the power to instantaneously send a tweet to someone who's like admits that they're struggling and being like, hey, I hear you. That must be tough. Like, if you need to talk, I'm here. Like, I've done that. I've seen other people do that on Twitter and Facebook, etc. By the same token, unfortunately, someone who is not compassionate or who is in their own pain and cannot see that and instead is externalizing that pain and making it about somebody else and is either bullying or, you know, basically bullying or, you know, misdirecting that pain and anger, whether anonymously or not, they have that same channel open to them. So it's really about what we do with it and what we're willing to tolerate or pay attention to. It's tough.
On the page for the film, there's a quote where you say, I open up, I feel doubt, and I shut up. Talk about that struggle to be vulnerable and to keep doing that in an ongoing way.
Yeah, it's a daily challenge, right?
I can tell you, for me, there have been times where I'll share something, and then I don't know, that night I go to sleep and I have this horrible dream like, oh, I shared this thing, and then like I wake up like, no, that's for real. What have I done? How am I going to get out of this? So did you all have moments like that where it's like, oh,
yeah, for sure.
We didn't mean to share that much. And yeah. How do we go from here?
Yeah, for sure. I was, that's funny. I was just today, I was on our Seed and Spark page for the campaign because I was, I actually was sending the film to our backers who were owed a download, which was really fun to, after 2 years, be able to deliver that. But there was a slight glitch at the time where the way it refreshed, I thought maybe there was something wrong with the video on the page, which doesn't really matter because it's 2 years old and it's just our pitch video for the page. But it was just like a weird browser glitch because everything was fine. But I had clicked play and I started watching the first few seconds of the video and then my face comes up and I remember, I could both see and feel and remember how terrified I was and how difficult it was to shoot my portions of that video.
Uh-huh.
Because of what we're talking about before about the vulnerability. And it's funny because now 2 years later, I've continued on this journey and we've finished the film and we toured around the country with it and we sat in theaters with people and watched it. You know, also, it, you know, even though it was its own terrifying process of reconciliation with the vulnerability. Just having the film finished and feeling proud of it was a big part of that, I think. But it's sort of getting better, but at the same time, like, I'm working on the script for what I want to be in my next film. And like, I'm thinking this is just going to start all over again, because I feel like I can't help but try to dig deeper into like these themes of like the self and what it means to have to reconcile with certain things in your life, and to be a person living in a society where we're like, our lives are increasingly augmented by machines and part of networks. So it's just like, it's you know, it's kind of like a mirror of life in a way. When you're making art, you're, in order to get anywhere, you constantly have to risk yourself as you explore, especially if your intention is to kind of create compelling stories, because that's the only way it works, or the only way that I've found for it to work is like, if I just try to tell a good story, I can do that and it'll be okay. But even for me and my taste in like watching a work by other people or reading books, to me, like, you can tell whether someone is like leaning on experience or craft and like, you know, maybe even doing good work, and when they're trying to like figure something out. Like, I remember when I was younger, like I used to take issue with the write what you know kind of edict that gets thrown around a lot, because I don't disagree with it. I just think that it's an incomplete thought and it's often misapplied, or it can easily take the attention off what for me is the most important thing, is that we, in my opinion, we need to be writing after what we're trying to find out. So just that process in general, when you add the condition that, you know, we don't create art in a vacuum, and like the, you know, chicken and egg relationship between artists and audience, like if I'm sitting here alone writing things and sticking them in a drawer or not shooting them, their scripts, then maybe I'm risking myself on the page and feeling vulnerable like alone, but like I'm not really risking anything. I'm not really vulnerable, and I'm not going to necessarily grow as a person or grow in my relationship with society, which I think is also a big part of like the impetus to create and to share and to communicate around things. So I just think that especially early on, we have to take our knocks and like live with those like nightmares. And like, sometimes like, I don't know, like I'm sure there are some things that I've written that an argument could be made that, you know, I could have kept that to myself, but I think we're seeing, and that's even been a judgment of some people, like, you know, my age and younger in particular, but I'm not.
Where it's like oversharing.
Yeah.
You mean? Like,
and I'm really not sure I believe in that.
Really? There's no such thing as oversharing.
I think that, when there's choice in it, like when people are going to particular channels where they can make a choice to continue to listen to whatever, listen to or watch whatever someone's sharing, that's like one thing. Like, I don't know if I would want to, you know, be forced into hearing someone's life story every day, like on the street, but they can also start telling their life story in the street and people can choose to stop and listen. And if they hear some part of their story in that, which it's a kind of an unwieldy like subject that we can dig into in many different layers, but I do believe in the universality of like human experience. So a lot of times when quote unquote oversharing is criticized, it's because, you know, the people who are doing the criticism are being confronted with thoughts or feelings that they don't want to deal with in the moment, which is fine.
I don't know that I'm entirely on board on that point. I think sometimes it can also be the person sharing not considering or caring about his or her audience, right? It's sort of like, I want to share this thing regardless of how others react to it. I'm trying to think of the nice way to say it. Sometimes there's not. I saw a staged reading of a breast cancer play, and it was one of the most miserable experiences of my life. I appreciate what they were trying to do, like trying to address a tough issue and have a discussion, but man, like the execution, painful. Yeah. To watch. How did you all go about bringing a little bit of lightness and joy and affection to a film that is dealing with a heavier topic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I just first to respond to your point, I totally see what you're saying. My counterpoint would be, if it's even a counterpoint, but because I agree, but I think that's a further issue of audience. It's like, well, we're in this weird environment now where like niche audience is more and more important or more and more like necessary or relevant or even possible. So it's, but your point also, you know, kind of lead me to backtrack the statement a little bit in answer to your second question or your second point, which is, and to return what I was saying before, is as I do, for me personally, I do believe that the relationship between the story and its intended audience is just as important, if not more important, than my needs or mine and my collaborators' needs as the artist or as the filmmaker. If I'm choosing to tell this particular story or felt compelled to do so, hopefully it's a product of having been thinking about not only myself, but about other people and our relationships with the world or with whatever it is that the film is about. So I think what you're observing is our intention to, from the, you know, my intention from the script phase, and then definitely something that was brought, in my opinion, beautifully to life by the three main actors and all the actors in smaller roles as well, is we really wanted the characters to be recognizable as like real people in today's society. That also came out of our approach of like doing what we can with what we have where we are, to borrow from like the you know,
write what you know, man. Write what you know.
Well, I'm thinking about the Teddy Roosevelt quote that gets floated around a lot.
Okay,
which is kind of like a thing that people share a lot in the startup world, where we've tried to model a lot of our operations after, to a point, without it being like obvious or like overly intentional to the point where it's not helping the film. You know, we wanted to make New York City as it looks like for, you know, some people or a lot of people, Brooklyn as it looks like for Margaret. We wanted to see these lives represented more like they feel to us as people living in these places, rather than what you see on like Girls, for instance, which is just an incomplete picture.
Okay. Interesting. A little, what, too glamorized or too what?
Yeah. And I'm a fan of the show and there's a lot of great things about it, but you know, the racial diversity, the economic diversity, the size of the apartments, like the ease with which, or the lack of ease with which certain things like just work out for people. I mean, it's a TV show as well, so like shortcuts are going to be necessary, and I don't mean to pick on it, but it, you know, the fact of the matter is the lives of the characters look less like what the lives of many young New Yorkers look like in reality.
Right. I mean, it still does the TV thing a little bit, where they have, they might be going through struggles, but they're like idealized struggles in a posh apartment. I don't know the show intimately. I've just seen little bits here and there, but I think that's what you're getting at, maybe?
Yeah, well, also the ease with which sometimes like problems are solved in these miraculous ways.
Ah, right, right. Like within an episode. Yeah, that's the whole TV thing, right? Like the life's big problems are solved in 30 minutes or an hour, and you move on to the next posh event with your friends.
And I love TV, and I think there's a lot of great TV, but especially outside the realm of like clear genre, I think that can be dangerous when people spend so much time every day absorbing those kind of narratives only or in excess, which is not necessarily faulting the audience. It's what's fed to us and what's advertised and what's like dressed up and thrown in front of us all the time. But it's another motivation for making this film or making the films that we've made in general, or like motivating me career-wise. It's like, it's just too far apart right now in terms of like what life actually looks like for most people and what life looks like on TV or on our, you know, in our movies that we see or are fed most of the time. I think independent film has a crucial role to play in combating that a little bit and rebalancing that a little bit. But even arguably the independent film industry, which has had to justifiably pick up a lot of slack from the hollowing out of the studio system, where fewer mid to lower budget films are being made, there's just a big need, I think, for a little bit more of reality in our fiction, which sounds like contradictory. But to return a little bit to your question, that doesn't mean that we can't tell stories or that we can't frame these discussions in narratives that have clear arcs for these people. One of the big intentions and the big challenges that I wanted to take on with this is like, all right, if we're shooting a film that takes place in New York City for $20,000 and we're shooting in like 12 or so days, like it's really going to be a challenge to tell to craft a compelling narrative without any special effects or without any name actors that like can bring in more money and et cetera. So how can we do that? And I know that you like to discuss collaboration, and one way is with the collaboration among our cast and crew, who did a fantastic job with, you know, and the collaboration of our audience, who enabled us to make the film. But the other part of it was really taking seriously the responsibility to also make a good film that when people were watching it, they never necessarily had a moment to feel like they were watching a $20,000 movie or anything but professional actors doing their job seamlessly, so that you don't even notice that it's going on. It's in addition to just being recognizable as life, I wanted it to also have a little bit of that filmic magic, in that that to us is where we hope some of that hopefulness comes out, and where some of the joy that you noted becomes a little bit of an advocation. We're starting off in a place where Margaret is coming out of a depression, and she's like clearly in transition and struggling. And by chance, she starts a friendship with V. And then of course, you know, Cass gets involved in her own way. And we really wanted that journey from isolation to community among these characters to feel like something that was possible coming out of something that was familiar and recognizable in the journey from, you know, fear and isolation again to hopefulness and community.
Yeah. And another thing that's striking about the film is you have one of the characters who is sharing something on a video blog, although I guess it's kind of private. And then someone else comes across it and is inspired by the honesty and vulnerability to do something comparable. Have there been examples of that in your own life where you saw someone or saw some art and you said, wow, yeah, I can connect with this and I want to continue that?
So, yeah, I guess the best place to start would be to bring up Mark Maron's podcast, which is a big popular hit.
WTF.
And so I can answer the question a couple of ways by bringing that up. Like, first, I heard an episode several years ago with Sarah Benincasa, who's a writer and comedian, that really she opened up and was really vulnerable in speaking about the contents of her memoir,
this is on Mark Maron's show.
I want to say in 2012. She struggles with agoraphobia and wrote a book in large part about her experiences, and really opened up and also opened up in the episode. And it got me thinking about, you know, what I was going through, to the point where I wrote and ended up producing my short film Multiverse, which is about social anxiety and agoraphobia.
Oh, no kidding. That was a direct inspiration. Oh,
yeah, it was an almost direct inspiration. I mean, the idea didn't strike me right away after listening to the show, but I think it knocked some stuff loose that was a direct result of listening to that episode.
Got it. And it's sort of like, oh, she's being brave to share, and I can maybe take a risk and share something similarly personal.
Yeah. And then also just looking at Maron and being a relatively early listener and seeing him evolve over the course of his show. And, you know, that led me eventually to write a script with a character who was kind of a precursor to Margaret, who was starting her own podcast. That script ended up being put aside because it just wasn't going to work or wasn't going to happen. It was kind of like an early version thematically of the video blogs. So I kind of took a lot of the characters and themes from that and rewrote it also, because to me, vlogging felt a little bit more cinematic than podcasting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so clearly that was an influence as well. You know, even going more specifically into film, you know, Seed and Spark's been around for a couple of years. I met Erica from their company, and then
this is Erica Anderson, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I met her here in New York early on, and I met Emily. I can't remember when I first met Emily.
Emily Best.
Yeah.
The CEO of Seed and Spark.
The CEO. I think we've talked a bunch again on Twitter and then later in person. And it was another situation where this is a group of people who are starting a company, the philosophy behind which just overlaps with my philosophy in terms of just like their entrepreneurial approach. They're like trying to empower filmmakers, taking a realistic look about it, what it means to be an independent filmmaker today, which isn't pretty most of the time.
Yeah, the reality is like when the number side, at least for a lot of people, the vast majority can be kind of depressing. Yeah. But, you know, it's not about the numbers always, but it is an aspect of the...
It can be depressing because there are not as many films being made at the lower budgets. There are more films being made than ever before, crowdfunded or for like no budgets, and it's just oversaturating the market, and you have to spend all sorts of time and money and do all of these like gymnastics to try to get any attention for even a good film because there's just so much going on, and that's all really difficult. But at the same time, there's so much opportunity if you're willing to do the work to strategize and to like buckle in and look at the reality of what's going on and commit long term. And the industry is in the process of correcting itself or evolving. I don't know. I'm trying to figure some of that out even for myself. But yeah, it's again, it's like with the film, like there, you can't help but be discouraged. And I think it's important to sometimes, and I think it's important to acknowledge those feelings and give them validity. But then we can like kind of take a breath and take a step back and be like, okay, well, then what is possible with what is there, and can I accept that, and can I choose to be empowered instead of depressed? Because it benefits those who would rather have us inactive or rather have us continue to fall in line or to give up or to be discouraged or to, you know, rant on a blog versus making something and doing the hard work of getting it out there, to speak to my personal experience. You know, I'm an artist also because I feel like we really need some change in our society. And that's not necessarily going to be an easy thing to do. If it was an easy thing to do, it would be easier. You know, like the battles would be fewer and less severe. But and look, it's a hard thing to accept from the day to day because it's exhausting. I'm exhausted right now, but it's just where we're at.
So it sounds like you were also inspired by the vision of the Seed and Spark people, similar to how you were inspired by the things you heard on Mark Maron's podcast to open up and share in your own way and to create.
Yeah, the business side of it or the career side of it. Yes, Seed and Spark, Big Vision, Empty Wallet, who's been supportive of us again, like to speak to what I think is an issue, although an understandable one. There are good architectures and support programs in place to help independent filmmakers grow and succeed and excel, but they tend to be, you know, kind of gated communities where you have to know someone, and to know someone, you have to be in a certain place at a certain time, where if you're an average everyday artist struggling to get by, like, just can't get to these places, or you can't afford to volunteer for these organizations and work up the ranks or schmooze at festivals. Like, you're just struggling to make things at all and to keep on keeping on at all, which is also just a symptom of where we are in our economy right now. At the same time, is there still some great work going on in those organizations and in those circles? I think some of these organizations and other, you know, filmmakers that I've met and communicated with, we're realizing that we kind of have to support each other and band together and fill this gap where maybe you do now have to scratch together a couple of thousands of dollars or $10,000 or $20,000 and make a micro budget feature over the course of a couple of years and like really struggle to do that in order to just maybe get to the point where you can do that bigger thing that used to be a first feature in at a larger budget or with some more support from the industry or the system behind you. And again, like that's not thrilling when you look at what it used to be like, at least anecdotally, before the collapse of the DVD market and the recession. But if the alternative is to, you know, collaborate and trade ideas and be transparent and help each other out and maybe maybe succeed or at least live to fight another day, or to, you know, pack up and leave, or to just like be bitter, like I'm going to choose the one that has some real possibility behind it.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Marc Maron, because he was actually in my notes for something else. So I guess we'll go ahead and touch on this. Your film has a bit of swearing. I would say a little bit more than I prefer.
Yeah.
But I'm conflicted, right? Because it seems like a lot of the people who are having the most earnest conversations out there, like Marc Maron or Joe Rogan, another comedian podcaster, they're having these conversations. A lot of times there's an excessive amount of swearing, but there's also a lot of depth to them. And I think there's also that trend in cinema, in certain independent films, where there is more swearing, but that also allows for more vulnerability, right? And so I'm wondering, is it possible to have that kind of vulnerability without the swearing, or do they go hand in hand?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. So the first thing I'll say is like, I got into the sound edit for this film, and we're sitting in the studio and working on the mix. And that, as it went on, I was like, wow, I this is really the first time I'm realizing how often these women are just like swearing, which is like, you know, obviously I wrote it and directed it, so it's not as a big deal for me, but I just didn't realize the extent to which, you know, it was going on with fair frequency. But to answer your question, I think if you watch this film and you'll notice that when the three women swear, it's never as an insult or in confrontation. It's always an expression of frustration. And I think that for me, or in my view, a lot of times when we're compelled to swear, and I'm intentionally not swearing because it sounds like you might not.
It's not like I get offended by it, but this show, at least in currently, I'm trying to keep it.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Clean-ish.
My podcast has the explicit warning on every episode. But sometimes I think that we get so frustrated that we feel, at least, that the only thing that we can do is swear. It's like a shorthand that comes out, you know. And in the context of your question, I wonder if especially when you bring comedians into it, I think, again, a lot of the times, I think some of us who are compelled to create are doing so for personal reasons, yes, but for personal reasons tied to frustrations that we have with society or certain aspects of society. So it doesn't surprise me that some of the characters that came out of me in scripting this and in shepherding this film to completion, that at certain points, in both public and in terms of both private struggles where a character's frustrated with his or herself or what he or she, I should say she, because they're mostly just women in the film, what she is feeling and can't figure out and maybe wants to, or wants to be soothed out of, that maybe she can't do anything more than express that frustration with a taboo word. Or, you know, I think there's one where Margaret is early on, when Margaret is still kind of blaming the outside world for her problems. She's kind of saying like, well, this isn't like swearing a bunch maybe, and saying like, how come I have to deal with this when it's not even my fault? Whether it's her fault or not, it's still her responsibility. So I would hypothesize that it might have something to do with just this kind of spontaneous need to turn to the, you know, to a taboo term to express a frustration that maybe, you know, one feels cannot be expressed in any other way.
You know, I noticed something interesting when I was reading up on some of your work, and I went back and read some of your blog posts. The only one that I found that starts off with a swear word, with an F-bomb right away, is the vulnerability paradox, which was interesting to me. Again, tying into that thing I've noticed in others where there is that heightened vulnerability that sometimes comes with swearing. I can say that in some cases, there seems like there can be value for some people. On the other hand, of all the political candidates, Donald Trump is the one who seems most inclined to swear. And so I'm like, well, yeah, there's something that is also appealing to me about decorum. But again, I'm conflicted on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it brings up another possibility as well, which is, you know, generally, you know, with no intention really to stereotype, but I think, for instance, comedians, and I have a lot in common with comedians in terms of my makeup and even some of my work. There's kind of this easily triggered defensiveness. So, you know, it could be a little bit of each. It could be one or the other, but it's like, you know, when you're bringing out the context of that post that I wrote about vulnerability, it's quite possible that, you know, I needed to get that out.
I understand. I mean, I think I get that it can be a defensive thing for people, and that it allows for some additional honesty and vulnerability. Like in those cases, I'm like, all right, well, I can see the value that it has for some people.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like, I think I would feel differently about it in the context of the video blogs. If they were character, like the video, like in the video blogs, it would not make me happy as an outside viewer to watch that film being otherwise being the same that it is and having a character swear at another character. Like that's not an emotionally safe thing to have happen to any of the characters in this film.
Okay, good. I like that distinction that it's more private and it's not done as kind of a stylistic in your face, we're so cool kind of thing,
yeah.
Which it was when it's probably the most grating to me. So yeah, that's a good point. You do have that distinction in the way it's handled.
I'm trying to think if there's a moment where one of the characters swears in the presence of another, and I don't know. I think you're right. I think it also can be a way to get some of that fear of the vulnerability out so that the vulnerability can fill in. It's like, again, when you were talking about the blog post, I'm wondering, oh, I wonder if that was my way of like putting up not a wall, but like a glass wall. So I'm, you know, dropping the F-bomb and then there's a wall going up, but it's a glass wall through which you can see the rest of what I'm going to show you in this post.
Yeah, and that post actually ended up being a really heartfelt one. So I can see that it has utility for some people. But let's see, changing it up a little bit here, the performances of your three actors, very good.
Yes.
Very, very heartfelt. And it seems like vulnerable for extended periods of time.
Yeah.
For much of the film, not just like a moment or two, and then they go and do their little silly, you know, like if this was a big blockbuster film, they would go and do their silly girls' night out thing, right? And have like martinis after another, and there would be that sequence. Although, you know, nothing wrong with that. But I mean, you are getting your actors to perform in a vulnerable way for much of the film. So I was wondering how you went about doing that.
Yeah, carefully with respect to their kind of their emotional well-being and their emotional capacity.
Uh-huh.
So for instance, there's, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's one very emotional scene in the film towards the end with Margaret and V, and we shot that once.
Oh really? Your big signature scene just one time? You're like, yeah, all right, nailed it, done. Out.
No. So we shot it once, and there was, you know, we got cameras and like we gave it a second. I was crying. The other cameraman was crying. everybody was crying. But we had two cameras, so we got two angles, but there were four angles, if you might recall, in the scene, or there's three. So we needed, we needed a little bit more coverage. Like, we just needed it. There might've also been like a slight adjustment that we had to make. And so I had to ask, I said, can you ladies do one more? And I'm pretty sure they both said, yes, one more. And that's mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Because that's all we have.
It's not the kind of scene or scenes where you want to do like 20 takes and we're going again. Let's go.
And if it were up to me outside of that, like, I might have tried to get another angle, for instance, or I might have even had one on paper. But as soon as we were done with the second one and I knew that I had the scene and I had what was most important, I think it's a responsibility to take care of, you know, your actors, as they're taking care of you and taking care of the story. So I didn't push. There were a couple of scenes where that happened. There's one scene where Rebecca's crying, and it's really like, not one scene, there's one cut where Rebecca's crying in her therapist's office. Rebecca's crying. Rebecca's character is crying in her therapist's office. And, you know, for all purposes, unfortunately, as written on the script, that was not a continuation of like a long conversation where she broke down in the therapist's office. That was a peek at what was going on in her character's psyche at the time in the story. So it was a cutaway, ultimately. So she had to do all of that work on her own, which took a little while, which took us kind of like asking some people to leave set. It was hard, and it was hard for me to watch, especially as her partner, but you know, she's a professional and she did it and it worked. And, you know, I, again, like, not even as her partner, but as the filmmaker, you know, after that, I wanted to make sure that, you know, that she got this time and space that she needed, or like a bottle of water, or like whatever she needed, because I do that suffering in private when I'm writing, and that's not easy. But to do it publicly, first on set in front of cast and crew, and then to have it be something that you know is going to be broadcast, it's a big risk. And I really respect all three women in the fact that they did it, that they trusted me on set to open up in that way, and that they put work into doing something that was so difficult. Because, you know, to speak to a little bit quickly to Phoebe's preparation, like, she, in the way that she works, she had to kind of like dive into her own personal story to prepare for certain scenes. And so when she was getting ready to do that, again, like the two of us who were on crew that day, because that was most of the days we were like a crew of three at most.
And that probably helps for those cases. So you don't have like 20 people there. You're opening up to like two or three people that you've gotten to know over time, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So yeah. So just to wrap up, I think that, that's right. And we just had to, you know, give her the space and let her tell us when we were going to roll the cameras, which like some directors might make them uncomfortable because they're control freaks. But for this project in particular, and increasingly for me, as I try to get better as a director of actors, like, that was fine with me. Sure. Tell us when to roll and then we will.
I like that. That's a good approach that probably a lot of people don't think about. Do you allow your actors in those moments to do a little bit of improv, or do you want to see them still hit everything spot on?
This script was the first time that I think I got pretty good about letting go completely as the writer, or at least becoming less the director that needed everything to be perfect in terms of what was on the page, versus what spontaneously was going to be perfect in the moment and therefore better for the eventual edit, where everything would start again with making decisions. There are plenty of places in the finished film, both in the dialogue and in the way the story was even put together, where what is on screen is not necessarily what was exactly scripted. And I think the film is better for it.
So any other memories or stories that you have that you want to share, either in the making of the film or in the process of sharing it with others traveling the country, hearing perspectives that really touched you and inspired you as a filmmaker?
Yeah, that has been one of the, if not the most rewarding part of this project. I mean, it happened with Multiverse as well, which was very touching for me. I remember once Multiverse, somebody was sharing, other than me, was sharing Multiverse on Twitter, and I got a tweet from someone who I didn't know, or I was on a tweet that someone wrote who I wasn't connected with, who just wrote this. He shared the film and said, "This is how I feel." And I was just like,
"That's a nice compliment."
Yeah, I was just
this,
like,
"This describes me in so many words, or without words, I guess."
Because on the one hand, I was like, "Well, I've done my job," and on the other hand, I was like, "I did my job such that this person was comfortable enough saying that."
Yeah, that's quite a compliment.
I seem to recall saying, you know, "I'm glad to hear that. And, you know, if you want to chat, like, let me know." Like, I usually try to do that. I like to leave that possibility open when someone expresses a connection to something that I've said that I've felt as well or do feel. The next thing that I was going to say is that with the video blogs, there was just no greater sense of like satisfaction and like pride than when we were on tour. The response just in general from the audiences in the 10 cities now that we've played in, the response has been really encouraging, but the couple of particular things that have happened in different cities over and over again, which has been wonderful, is we've gotten the sense from people that we have done the topic of mental health justice. There were people saying like, "You really captured what it feels like, or how it feels for me to be depressed or to struggle with, for instance, anxiety." There's a couple of scenes where Cass, who we haven't talked about much, Masha King's character, opens up with about her anxieties, and a lot of people have related to that, to kind of her character's compulsion to like be okay while there's all this stuff going on underneath the surface, even if she's not necessarily struggling with depression or mental illness. So there's been that. There's been a lot of people who have or are suffering from depression or anxiety who have come up to us and said, "You really captured what it's like, but also, you know, the hopefulness of it." We've also met a lot of people like us who have become advocates for the cause or activists for the cause of mental health destigmatization. So that's been wonderful. We've partnered with some local mental health organizations in cities where we're screened, and some of the people at those organizations who were really helpful to us in spreading the word about the screenings came up to us afterwards and thanked us for making the film and for, you know, doing what we've done or could do for the subject and for the population that deals with this directly. But the other thing that I really love that's happened is some people who were in the audience who enjoyed the film but didn't relate to it directly in terms of the mental health aspect. They might have liked it for other reasons or just in general. They, during the Q&A sessions after the screenings, you know, raised their hand and asked the question, "What can I do? Like, how, if I see someone suffering like this, or if I think someone might be suffering like this, how can I talk to them? What are the things that I could say that would be helpful versus hurtful? Or how can I be more respectful of the fact that some people are dealing with this in private, even though I may not have known it?" Those two things, like feeling like we've served the community in the way of representation, but also in terms of showing others gentler, more compassionate ways to help someone who is suffering a mental health crisis, even if they don't have a mental health illness, that's just been the best part of this whole thing. And we're hoping that continues throughout the life of the film.
Yeah, those two things sound like positive affirmations that you are moving in the right direction. All right, last question for you. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know to get the best out of you?
Well, so the first thing that comes to mind is that, in my opinion, at the end of the day, we're any of us collaborating, no matter what we're doing, like, we should all, as professionals, be working to and constantly considering what's best for the story. That doesn't mean just the script that I may or may not have written in this scenario, although I probably wrote it because that's usually when I end up, that's what I do. But that's the first thing. It's hard to do sometimes, and there are boundaries, of course. I think some directors take it way too far, and to me, like, that's losing sight of the actual importance of being of service to the story, because if you're not taking care of yourself and your cast and crew, then ultimately the story is going to suffer, in my opinion. Additional to that, as we touched upon, I think we always want to be thinking about how we can serve the audience through the telling of the story. That should be another kind of primary consideration, something I would like to be better at in the future. When I think about like how I can be a better filmmaker, that I could share with a collaborator such that they might be able to like look out for this thing for me, is to be more accepting, having more faith and being more accepting that like things are going to work out, and that we can kind of both address the challenges that are inevitably going to come up, but also enjoy the ride. I've met filmmakers who are just a little bit more able to follow things where they may lead and trust that what has to get recorded by the camera will get captured because of the contributions of everyone involved, which, you know, requires a degree of work and trust ahead of time. But I would like to continue to get better at recognizing and capturing and really like pursuing the organics of storytelling, so that what's happening live while we're shooting that will never be like seen again is captured by the camera and becomes part of the raw material that supports like further permutations of that sort of behavior in editing and throughout the life of the film.
That makes sense. Sounds like a good goal for you as an artist. All right. Well, Michael, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. People want to learn more about you or the film. Where would they go?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some of my experiences and opinions and my reasons for my potty mouth characters. Videoblogsfilm.com has all the details about the video blogs. We are also on Facebook. We have a pretty good size audience there, and we post stuff on our page. You can sign up for our email list for updates. And of course, it's on iTunes, Amazon, and those other channels. And for me, I have a website, mdibiazio.com, which is the hub for my podcast, Coffee with Creatives. I still blog there sometimes, though not as often lately while the film's been going on. You can see some of my work there as well. And I'm on Twitter at Michael DiBiasio, and I'm on Facebook and Willing to Talk there, and on Instagram, all under that same name.
All right, great. Yeah, it sounds like you're a very accessible guy. We'll see if we can get people to say hello to you on all of those platforms somehow.
To echo that, if anybody has any questions about anything, I'm happy to try to answer them. They can shoot me a note on Twitter is probably the easiest way.
All right. Yeah, that's very generous of you. Well, you enjoy the rest of your week, and thanks again for joining us.
All right. Take care, Nick.
Bye. All right. So that's my interview with Michael DiBiasio. Lots to take in there, and I want to say I do appreciate his honesty and willingness to talk about challenging topics like mental health, or even just trying to make a living as an independent filmmaker. In preparing for this episode, I watched some of the other things that Michael's worked on, including Multiverse, a short film that's got a surreal, maybe a hint of sci-fi to it, but really embodies the feeling that I've had going to certain social events where it feels like, oh man, like everyone feels kind of strange and otherworldly. So that one's worth checking out as well. I'll include a link to that in the show notes. And it also stars Rebecca De Ornelis. Telling these kinds of stories is important if we consider that art, film, literature, it's not just there for entertainment. There's that to it. And there's nothing wrong with those kinds of stories that are pure entertainment, pure escapism. But I think there's also value in
the stories that try to help us understand each other better in a more honest way. And again, hats off to them for tackling a complicated story, an issue-driven story, and doing it in a vivacious way. Doesn't always happen. As you heard, I had that experience with the breast cancer story, and you might have been thinking, oh, look at you, you're the jerk who doesn't like these stories about people struggling with illnesses. It's like a woman's story, you hateful person. No, it's not like that. I don't mind a well-told story that addresses those kinds of things. I enjoyed Still Alice quite a bit, a film female-driven, starring Julianne Moore, about someone facing an illness, in that case, Alzheimer's. But that one had life to it. It had more than just the illness, more than just the heaviness. And I think that's what happens sometimes when some of us feel compelled to tackle these challenging things, social issues or what have you. And we say, oh, wow, this is such an important issue. We really want to make sure people feel it. And there's value in that, but that of itself does not make good drama. And sometimes I think the issue is that when we try to tell those kinds of stories, we just focus on that, on like, oh, look, isn't this terrible, this thing, this condition, it affects so many people, we've got to do something, get funding, get people aware. All right, that's a valuable instinct, inclination to cause people to pay attention to something. But it's also about dramatizing that, telling that in a human way. And we are complicated. I mean, look, go to even a funeral or something really tragic, and you're going to see sadness. But there's also going to be life there. There might be kids playing around. There might be a little smile. There might be a friendly hug. A joke told at the reception that doesn't relate to death. I mean, we can take only so much tragedy, and then we've got to have something else, some kind of life to keep us going. It's just how we work as humans. And the video blogs, as I mentioned in the interview, does a nice job of dealing with a heavy topic, giving it the weight it deserves, but also telling a story that has life to it. Not an easy thing to do. Two of the things that we talked about in the interview stayed with me for days after the conversation, and I've been thinking about them. I guess they kind of relate. I wanted to explore them a little bit further here. And that would be the effect of swearing, whether it can have a positive effect, and whether there is such a thing as oversharing. In the past, I've written about swearing. I wrote a blog post about it, about the pros and cons. I'll link to that so you can take a look. And I've talked a little bit about it on the show. It's not like I want to keep beating a dead horse, but it is something that comes up in drama and in the world at large. And I'm curious about the effect of it. A couple of things that I encountered after the interview that had an extensive amount of swearing that related to our conversation. So I wanted to mention them, specifically All or Nothing, which gives you an insider's look at the Arizona Cardinals in the 2015 season as they're fighting for Super Bowl glory, trying to get their first Super Bowl win ever. And there's quite a bit of swearing in the organization. Really, really engaging series. Fascinating to me to get that kind of insider's look at the team striving for excellence as a group. And then there's the Tony Robbins documentary, I Am Not Your Guru. And he's also swearing quite a bit in that as he's trying to help people. So initially it was like, okay, well, maybe this is a way that it does bring out action. It helps people try harder, gets them more engaged. But then when I was watching All or Nothing, there were times where I was a little defensive, where it was like, man, if the coach or the teammates were talking to me like that, I don't know that that would have an encouraging effect on me. Maybe it was just me, though. And the team did quite well. They got so far, but notably, they did not make it to the Super Bowl. They came close. Well, what are you going to do? But then, in contrast, there are some other successful coaches who are opposed to swearing. Tony Dungy, who's won a Super Bowl, is opposed to it. So was John Wooden, the legendary UCLA basketball coach, considered the most winning basketball coach in history. He had a streak of 7 championships in a row, I believe. For him, it was like, well, no, we don't want to encourage that because we want our players to have a sense of discipline. Okay, so for some people, it maybe makes them work harder, but it seems like others can win without it. For Tony Robbins' documentary, another interesting example, I mean, he was using it when he's talking to people who are facing hurtful things, trying to make themselves better. And he's actually able to connect with them. And I did like the film in spite of my initial aversion to it. In fact, when I first saw it and he started swearing, I'm like, oh, here we go. This celebrity in your face kind of guy. He's swearing. And so I was rolling my eyes a little bit. At first, it was sort of like the caricature of what I think of someone like Tony Robbins, like, I'm a celebrity. I'm going to eat you if you don't do what I say. It was only as the documentary progresses that you say, okay, he actually does care about people, or at least he seems to in the documentary. And that was what was really engaging to me. And it seemed like that caring connected. And again, he uses swearing to break through, so maybe it has a positive effect, but it's also possible maybe he's doing that to get attention as a kind of, I don't know, defense mechanism, like we said earlier in the interview. And it's almost like someone who's swearing, they might have something of value to say, but they're going to have to work harder to win me over. And it just so happens Tony Robbins did. And so maybe it's positive in his case, but it's complicated, right? And then as we mentioned in the interview, there are the comedians who use swearing a lot, and they have these really profound conversations. And I am grateful to them for the depth of conversations they have, kinds of conversations that I don't hear elsewhere. But they do it with swearing. Do we need the swearing? I don't know. Maybe for some, perhaps. But on the same token, you have someone like Donald Trump, who is also more inclined to swear. And I mean, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, let's say we take a challenging topic and we throw in swear words. Would that be more or less likely to persuade you? I don't know. I was thinking, like, would the Gettysburg Address be more poetic if Abraham Lincoln had dropped a few F-bombs in there? I don't know. I don't think so. I think there's something to be said about having that sense of discipline and decorum in some cases. But then again, there's value in making it easier for honesty. So it's a fine line. I don't know where to go down on it. And along those lines, we have the discussion about whether there can be anything, any notion of oversharing. Is there such a thing? Can that happen? When we have this sense of, hey, no filters, man. Just say what you got to say. Use whatever language you need to say to get it out. Okay. Well, is that always true? Is that always valuable? I think in many cases it can be, because it's encouraging discussion on things maybe we wouldn't have talked about in the past. That older generations would say, well, you got to maintain a good appearance and don't air your dirty laundry for everyone to see. All right, now we've moved a little bit away from that as a culture. Well, I'm going to tell you what I really think. But there are some instances where that may not be ideal, right? And I mean, people can determine for themselves when to share and when not to share, but there are consequences. So I want to give you some examples, right? We have the idea now where some ladies are like, hey, it's my body. I can walk around exposed or unexposed, whatever. It's empowering to me. Deal with it. And some people are like, yeah, girl, get them likes. Yeah. But on the other hand, in older generations, we would have said, well, if you do that, that can encourage or evoke lust in others. And some guys are trying
not to give into that. It's difficult. I mean, these days, honestly, most of us are like three clicks away from porn, right? But there used to be the sense like, oh, hey, well, they are having a family together. He is making a commitment to her. She's making a commitment to him. They are raising kids together and they're trying to make it last. And that has more value than temporary gratification. That little feel good. Oh, look at you, girl. Yeah, you got more likes today. Awesome. Well, they had a family. They're trying to make that commitment to each other for the long term. And in the past, we used to say, hey, that's actually valuable. That takes effort. That's a difficult thing for these people to make that kind of commitment to each other, but it's admirable. And let's be mindful about the things we do. Maybe people having that kind of exposure, exposing themselves inappropriately, that might be oversharing because maybe the consequences are not ideal. Or we might have said, well, it's an admirable thing when someone can put together a business and employ people, several people, give them jobs, help grow the economy. Again, this is a little older way of thinking. We would have said, well, okay, if there are wrongs this company's doing, well, let's have a thoughtful way of addressing them. But let's be careful about having people speak out and just say whatever and maybe unfairly hurt that company, that employer who is providing jobs and helping the community in such a way, in a difficult way. Not an easy thing to do to stay in business. Now it's sort of like, hey, you know, you got an issue with your boss. Maybe you should speak up. Maybe you should get on whatever social media and blast him for it, even if you don't understand the situation exactly. I mean, sometimes in those cases, it might be appropriate for someone to speak out about frustrations at work, about injustices. But to do it in a thoughtful way, in a way that says, I have considered the situation, I've talked to people, I don't want to do unfair harm to this entity, but this is a wrong and I will speak up. Okay. But there might be other cases where it could just be, all right, that person had a bad day. I've had bad days at work. I'm sure you've had bad days at work. And if we were to take a microphone and voice those frustrations, that could do damage to a reputable entity. Maybe it was just a misunderstanding. And we could have gone on a little social media rant and then realized the next day, oh, I misunderstood. Oh, it's a good thing I didn't say anything. Okay, so it seems like Michael and I have a little bit of a different threshold on what is and is not appropriate to share. It seems like he's a little bit more inclined to say like, hey, I'm not sure if there is such a thing as oversharing. If it feels right, if it's the right audience, go for it. I'm a little bit more cautious, but that's okay. When discussing complicated topics, there's going to be some disagreement if we're having honest discussions. But overall, I like the direction of the conversation. I like what they're trying to accomplish with the video blogs. It could have easily been something that didn't work for me, considering our differences, and yet I still embrace it. And I think that's because of the sincerity and the vulnerability that he brought to it and his collaborators brought to the project. On his site, he talks about having hopeful narratives for complex people, and I think that intention is exactly right. We are complicated people. And sometimes in our stories, we want to simplify them, idealize the people, and smooth over the rough edges. That has appeal. But there's also something to be said for exploring that complexity, but not doing so in a way that leads to despair. I mean, look, even in the past week or two, I've gone through a pretty wide range of emotions when working on film projects. It can be kind of like that. Some days it's like, oh, good. Yeah, it's all working out. It's coming together. We just got this big piece or someone agreed to help us. And then another day it's like, oh, no, it's going to cost so much. And look at all these roadblocks people are putting up in our way that seems unnecessary. And is this ever going to work? And then I get similar things with relationships in my life, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, I'm connecting. And then other days someone will say something and it'll hurt. Sometimes it'll hurt quite a bit and I'll try to play it cool. But then for a day or two or longer, I'm thinking, why do I even try? Why am I even putting myself through this? And then I'm like, all right, can I find the strength to make it through this day? And I'll check the score. It's like, well, come on, if the Mets could just win this game. And of course they lose. They lose to a team that is, they've got a losing streak. They lose to teams who are losing badly right when they have a shot. Like, well, are we going to be able to do this? Are we going to be able to go to the playoffs 2 years in a row for some freakish reason? Almost, we're almost there. No, we're going to lose to a team that's got a horrible record several times. Speaking of mental health challenges, I mean, supporting certain New York teams is just, I don't know. I'm sure there are professionals who can explain the insanity. Why do you keep going back? You know they're not. No, I got a hope, a little hope. Come on, they're going to do it. They're going to make it work. No, of course they lose. Not to go on too much of a side tangent, but as Bill Mayer says, they call them the Miracle Mets because it is a small miracle if they can remember to win even once. All right. But anyway, I can relate. I find it a little reassuring to see a project like the video blogs to see, all right, well, others aren't going through exactly what I'm going through, but it seems like there are others out there who don't have it all figured out, are working on it, are trying to take positive steps forward. And sometimes that can get a little complicated, a little messy. I see that kind of honesty on their part, and it's encouraging to me and inspiring. It makes me want to say, all right, let me take that and pay it forward in some way, do my own take on it somehow. Maybe it's this conversation or something else. I don't know. But it does have that effect. And as we touched upon, that is a part of the story about how one person in the story shares something personal, honest, vulnerable. Someone else sees it, reacts, does similar things. And over time, it can have a snowball effect. Michael even mentioned how that kind of happened from something that he heard on another podcast. Well, speaking of keeping the conversation going, we're actually talking about a way that we can continue this conversation. If the pieces all come together, you might even get a chance to talk to Michael or some of the people who worked on the film while watching the film, perhaps. It is something we're talking about. We have a couple of people who have expressed interest, and there might even be some special bonuses for participating. This is a collaborative show, right? We're celebrating the art of collaboration. Why not put that to action and have an ongoing conversation about filmmaking, about mental health, all those things. Anything that we've touched on here and anything addressed in the film is fair game. More on that to follow. But if that's of interest, let us know. Leave a comment on the page or shoot me an email, podcast@ncivitis.com, and you'll be the first to know about how it will unfold. It's pretty neat. I'm excited about the possibility. I know sometimes these little things don't always line up, but I think it might come together. I'm cautiously optimistic here. Let's see what happens. Let's see if we can keep the momentum of this conversation going. And speaking of keeping it going, I want to say, and it ended on a positive note here, right? I was born in New York, some of you know. So I have some allegiances. So it's not like I'm a fair weather fan for the Mets, but two games in a row, they have won. It's a small winning streak, but it's something. Let's see if we can keep that spirit going in some way. Okay, that's our show. What questions do you have? What's your thought? Is there such a thing as oversharing? Can language be used in a positive way? Even profanity? Is it positive sometimes? Huh? I'd like to hear your take. If you want to participate in that, again, leave a comment on the page or shoot me an email, podcast@ncivitis.com. Music for the show, beginning and the end here, provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. Yeah, seems about right for this show. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.